I think what you need here is, you know, boardroom executives saying, well, hang on, digital transformation actually is about business model and change or transformation. So actually, that's our role. It's not about technology, right? So it's not that I need to understand APIs or a million quid investment in SAP or IBM or anything like that. Nothing to do with that, right? If we all ultimately end up in a place where we know what we want to do, we can then have the people and we can get independent external assurances that this is the right solution to fit that box. But if they just go straight to, well, actually, you know, management want to spend a million quid or 5 million quid or 10 million quid, and the board actually don't really understand their business model, well, you know, they might as well flip a coin.
So, Jeremy, tell me, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, today we have the great pleasure of talking with Tony Moroney of Beta Digital. I've known Tony for over 30 years.
I'd just like to point out that he must be special to you because you got his name right.
I did get his name right. That's because I've been repeating it for 30 years. But
welcome,
unless,
Tony.
Unless you've changed your name, Tony.
Thank you, Ollie.
Very
no,
confusing.
I haven't, Jeremy. No, very good. Still the same.
Well, Tony's managing director or senior partner of Beta Digital. And I've got Tony on because Tony's going to talk to us about digital transformation. And it seems to me that digital transformation brings together an awful lot of the subjects we've been talking about. And therefore, Tony being an expert in this area, I thought it'd be great to have that conversation. So welcome, Tony. First of all, are you, I know what you are. I was going to say, are you an old fox or a young fox? But after my introduction, you can only ever be an old fox, I imagine.
Well, yes. I suppose, Jeremy, like most people, probably born pre-internet, so that probably automatically makes me an old fox. But I would be working hard to make sure that I have the mindset of a young fox.
Good man. So first of all, can you tell us what you would describe, what you mean by digital transformation?
Okay, yeah. So this is one of these things that everyone is talking about, digital transformation. But to me, the word digital is a bit of a misnomer. And it actually starts to create all sorts of problems in organizations because in reality, this is about transformation. And for us, it's, can you actually, you know, look at your organization and understand why it really exists in the first place? And for most organizations, they can't because the original founders were very clear on why they set the business up. But then, you know, they move on or, you know, things happen and then operational excellence takes over. And then suddenly there's a big disconnect between the firm and its customers or its markets. So for us, this is around transforming the business to be able to meet the needs of your customers in the future. And digital, as I say, it is a misnomer because, yes, there may be technology involved, but it's not the starting point. And the fact that people talk about digital transformation, it immediately becomes the starting point, which is a problem in itself.
And why did you get interested in this area particularly?
So I've been looking at this area for the last couple of years, Jeremy, and worked all over the world with, you know, institutions in different parts of the globe. And for me, I suppose when I was, one of the things I was trying to get my arms around was how do you actually prove to an organization that it is making progress? Because it's like one of these things, like grabbing mercury. And if you're talking about digital transformation, if I walked into any boardroom in the country and said, what do you mean by digital transformation? They all wrote it down on a page. We'd get different answers from every single person. We would have no common consensus in terms of what it is we're trying to do. So as I was working through different types of approaches to it, I came across a firm in Sweden who had actually worked with John Cotter, and they developed a methodology around understanding digital maturity, which is rooted in 9 digital motors, the most important motor being vision, mission, and values. Because you have to start from there. Otherwise, what happens, Jeremy, is firms rush in and they think, well, this is about IT or this is about marketing. And in reality, all they are doing is applying some sort of digital veneer to an analog organization. And fundamentally, they are not changing. So what I was trying to do and what we're doing in Beta Digital is bring it back to brass tacks. Why does the firm exist? Who are its customers and what are they actually trying to do for them? How do they create a great experience for them? And in that context, you might come across the need for technology, but you don't start there. So if I could put it this way, the problem for firms is they're starting to understand why. So people are understanding the world is changing. Every person out there is using, you know, MyTaxi, Uber, Netflix, you name it. So they can see the world is changing and they're starting to get that. The problem is they rush straight to what? And there's loads of what. So I could put 100 different technologies in front of you and sort of say, here's AI, here's robotics, here's whatever. But where do you start? Where you need to start is forget about the what and go back to the how. How is this organization going to transform? And once you have that right, well, the what becomes easy because you now understand what you need out of the what, as opposed to let's just grab whatever what seems expedient or whoever has the influence in the organization says is right for us.
Could you give us an example?
So if I walked into, say, a bank today, they would probably all say, oh, yeah, yeah, we need mobile apps or we need artificial intelligence or we need whatever. Right? But the problem there, Jeremy, is as invariably happens is you deliver a mobile app, but then you find the rest of the organization can't talk to the app, that the back office actually doesn't know how to use the information from the app to actually help the customer on their journey. So you get these big divides between digital initiatives and actual reality in the business. So I call it digititis, where you know firms continue to invest in digital initiatives, but they're not clear on their business model. And if you're not clear on your business model, you basically just all you can hope to do is be lucky in your random acts of digital, because that's all you're doing. You don't have a plan in terms of where you're trying to get to, and it's like the story in Alice in Wonderland where Alice asks the cat about which road to take, and the cat says, "Well, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there." Mm. And what I see happening in organizations is they are taking any road. And a lot of it is down to being able to say, well, oh, yeah, we are doing things. And it's worse than that, Jeremy. In some organizations I go into and I say, well, who's responsible for digital? And they say, oh, that's Jeremy. And Jeremy might be in charge of marketing or he might be in charge of IT or he might be the customer experience officer. But actually, in reality, Jeremy has no mandate, no budget, and no wherewithal to change the organization. So it's kind of form over substance. Yes, we're doing digital, but we're not really doing digital. And unless the organization from the top down is looking to embrace a new way of thinking and a new way of dealing with their customers, it will fail.
And so I guess you could almost, in that context, replace the word digital with change. Yes, we're changing, but we're not really changing, right?
Yeah, although change is probably too weak a word.
Okay.
It's transforming. Because if you think of it, so the likes of an Uber comes along and they say, well, what's the customer trying to do here? And then they say, okay, well, how could we build something? How could we create a great experience for the customer? And then they say, well, okay, how can we wrap that in, our culture, in our processes, in our technology, and deliver that to the customer? They don't say, well, okay, well, how do black cabs work today? And how could we put a bit of a digital veneer on that? They transform it. And the risk for incumbent firms is they do a lot of this incremental change and they don't stand back and say, well, actually, if you look out the horizon, there's such change coming down the tracks that our business may not survive. Now, Dell did a big survey on this and they talked to several thousand companies all over the world. I think it was 4,600 companies across 42 countries. And what they found is that 45% of firms believe they will be obsolete within 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years?
3 to 5 years, right? 48% of companies said they didn't know what their industry would look like in 3 years. So these are big issues that in reality firms are not grasping, because one of the challenges for management is management tends to focus on the day-to-day, right? And they're running their budgets and their quarterly numbers and this, that, and the other. Well, they're not necessarily standing back and saying, actually, in 3-5 years time this business will be fundamentally different. And I think a good way to look at this is if you are not digitally mature in your personal life, you're going to think your organization is more digitally mature than it is in reality.
I think we've all looked senior people in the face and seen that mirror.
Well, this is a classical old fox, young fox thing.
No, of course. And Jeremy, one of the things I do with firms from time to time, I say, okay, I put up a list of, you know, different social media devices and whatnot, and I say, who here uses these? And they use their phone to input which ones they use. And yeah, of course, most executives are using LinkedIn, and you know, maybe a little bit of Twitter, and maybe a little bit of Facebook. But the reality is, if their consumers and future consumers are using technologies that they know nothing about and they don't use, how are they going to design experiences for their customers? Because they're detached from them. Now, you take it to the next step and you say, well, if our customers are more digitally mature than us, that's going to be a problem, because their expectation, and bear in mind they're being educated by Amazon and all these companies on a daily basis, if their expectation of what they want from us is greater than what we can deliver, that's a problem. And then you say, well, what about my competitors? You say, well, if my competitors are more digitally mature and that's what my customers want, I definitely have a problem. Or if you look at your industry and say, well, you know, if Amazon was to come into my industry tomorrow, they are absolutely more digitally mature than me. And if that's what customers want, I'm in serious trouble. And if you look there this morning, there was an announcement about Uber Money. So you can't sort of, you know, look at these things in isolation. You have to start with, okay, we're an analog organization. I'm an analog executive, but I don't operate in an analog world anymore. So where am I personally? Where is my company? Where is the marketplace and my customers? And what is this saying to me about where I am today? But on top of that, you need to be saying, 3-5 years out, do I know which of the big changes that are coming down the horizon are fundamentally going to impact on my business in the future? And if I don't start planning for that now, based on an understanding of which ones matter, right, in 3-5 years time, you know, I may not be in business. So when Dell come back and say, you know, 45% of companies don't know if they'll exist, well, you know, it's not surprising.
Do you think there's a bit of a head in sand kind of overwhelm kind of scenario?
I think one of the issues is, back to where at the start of the conversation, when you hear the word digital, you immediately get connotations of technology. And most board members and most executives don't know much about technology. So they don't push. Where actually, this is a business model issue. Right? And the technology, that's an enabler at best, nothing else. Right? So I think there's probably a bit of, you know, they hear the words and then they say, oh, well, we don't know what this means, and it's something to do with technology. Or they falsely assume, well, actually, this is all to do with marketing and touch points and, you know, mobile apps and websites and whatnot. It's all that sort of touchy-feely stuff with the customer. So I think there's a genuine lack of understanding around boardrooms and executive tables in terms of what transformation actually means, and in that context, digital. And to put this in context, you know, they say we're in the fourth industrial revolution. Well, in the third industrial revolution, they had heads of electricity. So I say to firms, well, you know, you're talking about heads of digital or digital directors or whatever. But actually, you know, digital is just part of life. You know, so it's not about having a digital strategy. It's around making sure your strategy has a digital perspective. And there's it might sound like a small nuance, but it is a huge difference. If I'm looking at my strategy and I'm saying, yeah, okay, well, my strategy has taken account of all of the technological and other changes that are happening, I'm in a good place. If I'm saying, well, I have my strategy, oh, and by the way, I also have a digital strategy. Now I'm running two different organizations, but you know, the one that has the digital strategy is not the main organization. It's some department out on the side.
Do you know, I was talking to one of the major banks this morning about this very issue. And one of the issues that the frustration that's being shared by the digital team, and they are actually called the digital team, is that they basically, in so many words, said, we're building this thing, and alongside it, the rest of the organization is building the same thing with all the technology. And we need to convince them that our thing is the future and that that's why we exist. But as an organization, we are currently doing it twice.
Correct. And it's a huge issue, because if you look at big banks, typically, and here what I typically say to them is, so tell me, how are you organized? Are you organized around products and channels and things like that? And they say, oh, yeah. And I say, so you're not organized around customers. And you get this kind of blank look back. Well, we are. And I said, no, you just told me it's channels and products and whatnot. And fundamentally, banks are product-led companies. You know, they design products and they push them through distribution channels. And the customer, you know, that's not the starting point. The customer is kind of something that comes near the end, but it's not the starting point. And if Amazon comes into the banking market tomorrow, they will start with the customer and they will design from the customer in, as opposed to saying, well, actually, let's look at all the steps that we have today. So we've 10 steps and the regulator makes us do those three and audit makes us do those two. And the way we're established across different channels makes us do these ones. So let's just put a digital overlay on that. Now I've got the worst of both worlds because I now have something that still isn't right from a customer perspective, but I've actually added in the cost of digital.
Yeah, as a separate thing rather than as part of something that we do. And you know, as you were talking about Amazon, I was thinking, you know, the folks at Universal Studios and Time Warner probably didn't pay much attention when an online bookshop set up in Amazon. And maybe they paid a little bit more attention when the bookshop started selling videos and DVDs, but they never, I don't think, would have imagined that Prime Video would be bigger than many of them and its annual spend a few years later.
I think for me, the critical bit was what you said at the very beginning, Tony, which is your starting point is around mission, vision, values. It's around organizational culture, because those are the things that underpin everything else the organization does. And if there's no clarity around that and no commitment to managing a culture that enables all these other changes to take place in a holistic, collaborative way, you haven't got a hope in hell. I mean, I've had a few problems just recently with my internet provider.
Have you, Jeremy?
Yes.
I've heard a little bit about
you
this.
Have. Because I've been on the phone to these people for literally for 3 hours a day for the last 2 weeks, trying to get something to happen. And I'm sure that if you went into the senior management, well, I'm not sure actually, but let's assume you went to the senior management and said, you know, do you put customers at the center of your business? I'm sure they would say yes. And if you look at the way they're structured, clearly they've got a digital strategy, because if the thing is crawling with technology, you go into a customer service center and you're, first of all, you're processed by some sort of remote voice, sort of cataloging you and filtering you. Then you get projected somewhere else where people are reading from a script and they can't deviate from the script. And the whole process is just an absolute nightmare.
And they send you a survey before they answer your question.
Oh, do. Absolutely. how you would evaluate them. And then the moment they book the engineer to come and sort your problem out, suddenly you'll get another text telling you that because they've now solved your problem, they're going to cancel your order or whatever and have a nice day. And it is absolute madness. And I was comparing that with, I think when you and I first met, it was probably around that time, of the mortgage store in Dublin.
Oh, yeah.
Where there was I think it was Ted McGovern's idea that actually what you should do is use technology to sort of empower people in their work, not to replace people or be in front of people. And therefore, when you had conversations with somebody about a mortgage, they created this environment where there were easy chairs. It was like sitting in someone's front lounge. But just over the shoulder was a computer screen that was prompting certain questions or prompting certain actions. But it was there to enhance the conversation, not replace it. And again, when I've been talking to these different organizations, because clearly I decided to change my provider, different organizations are treating it in different ways. And some of them, I was getting a human experience. I was talking to people who were engaging me in a normal conversation, solving my problems and reassuring me and giving me the soft stuff that I wasn't getting in others. And it was, even though, until you experience it, you don't really think about it very much. You go to talk because of the price and, you know, and so on and so forth. So I do think that this is a huge, huge area that is even more ignored than the interface between the consumer and the sort of processes.
Yeah, but I was talking to University College Cork there recently. I did a presentation and I talked about Thomas Cook. And Thomas Cook is a prime example of a company that becomes disconnected from its market. And if you look at, you know, the Thomas Cook strategic reports and investor presentations over the years, you'll see all the wonderful things they're doing, digital innovation and this, that, and the other. Now, ironically, in 2013, they actually set up a digital advisory board, including outside people to help them understand, you know, the leading edge trends in online businesses, etc. Now, funny enough, they disbanded that a year or two later, right? But if you look at what happened, Jeremy, it's not that people didn't go on holidays. More people go on holidays than ever. But what people want out of going on holidays has fundamentally changed. And Thomas Cook's model was built around, we'll get you there, we will look after everything for you, and we will get you home. But the market has shifted. That might work for some customers, particularly elderly customers who like to go into a Thomas Cook shop and then get looked after. But for the rest of the population, they're using Ryanair, they're using Airbnb, they're using Hotels.com, Expedia. Also, if you look at what has happened around the world in terms of infrastructure has significantly improved. So you can go to places like Turkey and all those other places that may not have had the infrastructure 20, 30 years ago, and you can get by. But Thomas Cook stuck with his model. I think they called it enclave tourism, where, you know, everything is within their hub. But the market fundamentally changed. And the other thing that happened was Thomas Cook persisted with a model where they had to own the hotels, they had to own the planes, they had to own the travel shops, etc. Whereas other markets and other industries, you know, people are operating, owning nothing. So Uber owns no cars, Airbnb owns no hotel rooms, but it has more rooms than Marriott. So the model and the customer demand totally changed, and Thomas Cook failed to respond to it.
So thinking about this and knowing that there's a lot of businesses that are not changing as fast as they should, not transforming, to use that term, do you think that we have a problem in the way that leadership is hired, groomed, and perhaps even exited? Are we not training our leaders?
Well, I don't think we're training our leaders to think. I think one of the issues is, you know, if you have a 7 or 8 year old, which I used to have around the house, you get asked the questions why all the time. Why is this? Why? What about? Right? But when we go to school and we get into college and we go into work, actually, that gets knocked out of you, and you get told this is the way we do things. And here are the processes, and here are the procedures, and here are the audit controls, and here are the risk controls. And particularly given the environment in the last number of years, you get this fear of making mistakes. And so I think the ability to think and trial and test things probably gets squashed in our traditional organizations. And I think probably what we need to be doing is we need to be sort of saying to ourselves is, okay, how are we going to underpin creativity and innovation in our business? Because if you don't have innovation and you don't have the change management capability to go with it, and you don't have digital maturity, you will not be competitive in the future. So you need all three of those things.
And that comes back to organizational culture.
Of course.
And you get that, you have to get that bit right first. And I think that's the most difficult bit, because it seems to me that people are very comfortable. You give them a project around digital, or you give them a project around customer insight, and they can get on with it. And it's just the application of sort of learnt skills very often. But managing that whole system and creating an environment which allows these different disciplines to operate together in a holistic way, and to drive out the synergies and the creativity, and to enable people to feel that they can make a mistake. I mean, one of the things I find increasingly going into organizations and talking to organizations is this word fear, you know, the fear that there is in organizations. People are frightened of making a mistake. It drives other inappropriate behaviors.
They're frightened about other things too, aren't they, at the moment? They're frightened about Brexit, about mortgage rates, about so many things in their lives.
Absolutely.
They are. And I think though, and you're absolutely right, but fundamentally, if the board And it starts with the board. I mean, the board's responsible for strategy and arguably for culture. But if the board don't understand digital transformation and the fundamental changes that are happening in their world that are going to have profound implications for their business, they will continue to measure what they always measured. And therefore, failure is not acceptable. Right? So what the board need to be challenging hard is to the executive and to management, it should be saying, well, hang on a minute. Let's talk about our business model here. Let's talk about what's happening out there and how sustainable our business model in the future. Let's talk about the waves of change and which one of these waves or which of these changes are going to fundamentally change our marketplace. And tell me what we're going to do about it. But that's not what boards do. In fact, they're shielded from that conversation. Right? And what they get is, here's the market, and here's the economy, and this, that, and the other. And yeah, but that's fine. And of course, you need to manage the day-to-day business in the short term. But the board need to get out of their comfort zone and say, yeah, let's talk about our business model in the future, and let's understand the profound changes that are happening out there that will mean we either survive and prosper or we die, right? How many conversations do you think boardrooms are having around that? And I can tell you very little.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, how do you apply that to the majority of businesses that are actually small or medium sized and perhaps have a board of one or two and perhaps absentee or shadow board members?
Well, I think funny enough, you know, for the smaller firm, you know, it should be easier for them to see this. And of course, they can be very busy. But you would think in the smaller firm that actually they understand why they exist and what they're trying to do for customers. Well, when you get to the large firms, I mean, they are so far detached at times from their market and their customers, very hard for them to actually see, because what they're getting is a sanitized view of the world. And the problem is, back to the early part of our conversation, is if I don't understand digital transformation and I think it's a technology issue or I think it's a marketing communications issue, well, I'm not going to push in this space because that's not something I'm comfortable with. And whereas actually, if the penny drops with me, actually, this is about our business model, right? Of which, of course, marketing and IT and all those things, but actually, it's our culture. It's how we operate in terms of how we use strategy in our business, in terms of, you know, how we delivering value for customers, etc. Now that's a much more easy conversation for a boardroom to have or for an executive to have, but they need to realize that it's not about, you know, some big IT project or, you know, some IT vendor saying, here's a solution that we have for you that will meet all your future needs. It's not. It's about understanding our own business model and being able to understand the changes that are going to happen, that means we need to transform our business to anticipate and get ahead of it.
It's interesting because we've very recently had an episode on introverts and extroverts, and that translated ultimately to self-awareness within people, within managers, within leadership, and then within the way that organizations behave in society. And it seems that as the pace of change quickens, that and as the market globalizes and therefore competition can come from so many different places, that self-awareness is really a commodity.
Yes, indeed. And look, you know, the type of models as we mentioned there are changing. And you know, I think it is one of the things for the future. I mean, if you take someone like BMW, I think they have 116,000 employees. Uber has 7,000 employees, and it's worth more than BMW. Uber is 10 years old. You know, BMW is 105 years old or 104 years old, whatever the number is. And so the way the business model of the future will be different than the business model of the past. But a lot of our business training, so, you know, when we go into universities and whatnot and we're studying, you know, commerce or business or whatever, you know, a lot of it's built around strategic constructs that were designed 30, 40 years ago. And they're no longer that relevant.
Do you know, I was on a plane with a couple that had just graduated through a Swiss economics school. And I said to them, gee, you must have had an interesting degree compared to my commerce degree, because obviously, and they looked at me and I said, because of the crisis, right? And subprime and and now Brexit and all of these things that weren't around when I went to uni with my walking stick out. And they said, well, actually, Oliver, it embarrasses us to say this, but our economics books were all written in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and so was Porter, and so was, you know, all of these constructs, and they're still there. And what we need to be sort of saying, you know, to, you know, our you know, young, open potential managers and leaders of the future is actually the world is different. And you need to fundamentally rethink your business model. And you need to approach it in a different way that is not from the perspective of a hierarchical analog organization.
How do you approach them then? Because in theory, that's great. And my experience of going into organizations and trying to affect some sort of major change with them is on the surface, they're all up for it. And they all want everybody else to change. But when it comes to them, there's huge resistance. And some of that's sort of a natural biological thing, because we know that people fear losing something. The fear of losing something is a more powerful urge than the potential gaining something. So yeah, people tend to be conservative with a small c and resistant to change. So on a practical level, how do you genuinely affect change? Because it's I've seen it very rarely. I've seen lots of people talk about successful change management programs, but you go back there a couple of years later and, you know, they've reverted to type in many cases.
Yeah. So Jeremy, the big issue for most firms is they don't actually understand their starting point, nor do they understand their destination, although it's more of a journey than a destination, because you'll never reach, you know, where you need to get to, because the world just keeps moving on, as you know. So the first thing for us is to actually measure the digital maturity of the firm motor by motor, and within that, question by question. So behind each motor, there's a series of questions. Now, the absolute score in the first instance probably is not the most important thing, although it is relative to an index, because the first time around, a firm is most likely going to overscore itself, as in they will say they are better than they are in reality. Where it becomes really interesting is what we do is we analyze and produce a standard deviation by question and by motor. So when you now start looking at something and say, well, actually, hang on, there's a standard deviation within this motor of 24%. That means, you know, everyone's not pointing the same way, everyone's not talking about the same things, and everyone's not focused on the same things. You can start to immediately see, actually, there's just huge gaps in understanding, in attitudes, in approach. And it doesn't matter which motor it is, you can see those straight off. And I was with one organization there a while ago, and the CFO said to me, he said, well, you know, I'm here 10 years and I don't think this organization is broken. And I said, but no one said it's broken. And he said, well, you're making it sound like it's broken. And I said, no, this is your data. This is not my data. This is your data. This is you and your people saying actually you have different views of the world. Right? So if you start to understand the standard deviation, so if we say, well, the train goes from London to Edinburgh, but everyone has a different opinion in terms of what that means. If you can start to get everyone to understand, actually, it's a straight line, right? And here's how it works. Now we're all in the one space and we're all talking about the same thing. But the reality in most organizations is, you know, I might be talking about going to Edinburgh. You're talking about going to Glasgow, but think you're talking about going to Edinburgh. And someone else is talking about going to Birmingham.
And I'd rather get a plane.
Yeah, absolutely. But the point is that if people are not aligned, you have no chance of success.
Can you go and have a chat to Boris Johnson, please?
Or Southern Rail? I'd like either
Boris Johnson first.
Okay.
Well, indeed. And I think the issue for Boris is that, look, you know, because people are not on the one page.
They're not.
And it's the same in every organization.
Yeah.
So I could sit around the boardroom table and, you know, we get the Churchill nodding dog. Everyone says, yes, yes, yes. But actually, behind it all, they all have a different view of what they're talking about.
So what would you do if you walked in and you could talk to government? What process would you take them through at a high level?
Well, I think there's probably a couple of ways to it. But, you know, I mean, we need to take it out of the Brexit scenario. But let's say we're talking about digital.
Sure.
Right, or digital transformation of a government sector. Because in reality, you know, if you want your economy to be a digital economy, that government and all government services have to be right up there. So what you would need to do is, in the first instance, I would like to do is to get the officials or whoever is involved to start to understand, you know, what it is we are talking about. And it's not about automating the processes in the Department of Social Welfare or whatever it is.
Right? Do you want to maybe talk about the making tax digital as a reference? Because that's quite relevant to a lot of people.
No, absolutely. So what you would need to be looking at in that scenario there, you'd say, okay, well, let's talk about customers, be they personal customers or small businesses. We won't worry about the big corporates. You sort of say, well, what do we need to do? We need to make it easy for people to be able to do their tax. We need to be able to make it that actually, you know, we can actually liaise with, you know, in an ideal world, what you could do is they could fill out a form and we could actually interrogate their data, including their bank accounts, etc., and send them a bill as a credit or as a debit for what they owe or don't owe. And for businesses to say, well, actually, yeah, just give us online access to your bank, your accountants, whatever, and we'll work out all that for you, because actually the algorithms will give you an answer in 2 seconds, whether we owe you money or you owe us money. Now, that's a fundamental different way of doing things than what we have today, which is, well, we'll hit a deadline and we'll have a different deadline if you can do it electronically. But it's all still very antiquated in terms of the collection of data. In other economies, a lot of this data actually is publicly available, you know, and, you know, the revenue would have access to all of these type of things and they would know who owes money. So it brings a whole different debate around privacy and all those type of things. But I think if you look at the market, you sort of say, well, if we want the market to perform efficiently and effectively, we could take all the pain out of this. So, you know, tax returns are a thing of the past. Let's eliminate them.
Yeah, January would become a lot easier for a lot of people, wouldn't it?
It would, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I think government is a fundamental part of a digital economy. And what we need to do with government is sort of say, well, okay, if we look at the lives of the citizens of the state, you know, how does government enable and support that, and in a way that is seamless, transparent, and effective?
And some places have done this quite well, haven't they? If we talk about places like Estonia.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in other parts of the world that would be considered to be less well developed, they've actually, you know, gone with digital identities and all that sort of stuff. So you can open bank accounts, you can do whatever you want, all in a second, because there's no verification of who you are. It's all done. So it depends on what the consumers want, or the citizens want, and, you know, how does government get there?
Can you give us an example? Because I'm thinking a lot of listeners are going to be thinking, I know my business needs to change. How do I raise that conversation? What does that process look like for us to transform and survive and thrive?
Yeah. So when you say an example, what have you in mind?
Of a business that did transform successfully.
Mm. So Netflix is a company that transformed successfully. And you might say, well, hang on, Netflix is not one that transformed. It did, actually. Netflix started out in video rentals, the same as Blockbuster. The only difference was you sent it in the post. And funny enough, Netflix went to Blockbuster and say, look, you guys are much bigger. Can we do a deal and you take us over? And Blockbuster said, we don't need you. But Netflix at a point in time said, actually, this video streaming thing seems to be real. And actually decided to bet on video streaming. The net result, the market turned around and dropped its share price because they didn't believe the management. The rest is history. Netflix proved the model. I think also, if you think of someone like Apple developed the iPhone, right? And at the time, BlackBerry said, well, yeah, we'll be okay. We don't need to worry about this, right? Well, you know, BlackBerry sales, you know, just collapses, you know. But Apple didn't stop with developing an iPhone. They've developed iterations of the iPhone, but they've also developed a whole platform model around the iPhone. So suddenly you have all these apps that now make the app phone more than a phone. In fact, you know, I look at my kids and I don't know what they call it, a smartphone, because they actually don't ring anyone. They just communicate via it, right? So what Apple did was they turned a piece of technology into something that was a greater utility, which ultimately then started to drive and change behaviors. So if you think about it, so Apple came along, built the phone, then a load of open source guys came along and said, well, we'll build apps to, you know, create things for customers so they can do things. And then behavior started to change. And one example I like to give on this is Pokemon Go. So, you know, Pokemon Go reached 50 million in subscribers in 19 days. But what it did is it actually started to get kids off the computers and out of their houses onto the streets trying to find these Pokemon Go monsters or whatever they are. And then you had whole retail industries, pizza parlors and whatnot, all building stuff around that, sort of, you know, giving coupons off pizzas if you come and try find your Pokemon in their shops. So the technology actually can go all the way through to changing behaviors. And it's understanding that it's all three of those things, the technology and the services and the changes in behaviors. But Netflix to me is a great example. Microsoft is another one. Amazon is another one. Amazon started off as a online bookseller. Look at it today. And it has an ecosystem second to none and is continuing to invest and acquire and do all sorts of things, which are all on a platform model, which totally changes the way we as consumers think. And they've made convenience, you know, convenience is just, I suppose, an understatement in Amazon. It's just one-click purchase.
And another big part of that, I think, is that their digital platform for their online bookshop was so well executed that they started to hire it out to other people, didn't they? So a lot of businesses, perhaps as high as half, that start online these days are building apps using the Amazon toolset and the Amazon cloud, which is amazing.
No, absolutely. And look, it doesn't matter what you want now. You can get it through Amazon. And, you know, in the States, you can get it within an hour. And Amazon, their algorithms are so powerful now. They actually are building mobile warehouses where they can predict demand and have the things ready to be dispatched to you within an hour. So that's a whole different way of thinking. But they're all businesses, you know. I mean, so in many respects, you say Amazon, yeah, actually, it was kind of there to start the internet, but in a very narrow way compared to where it is today. And it started to change into web services and all sort of things, you know. So it's no longer an online book retailer. It is a platform business. And, you know, there are many platform businesses, and they are fundamentally changing, you know, the way consumers do things and think about things.
Does any of this worry you, Tony?
No, worry would be the wrong thing. I think probably if you look out into the future, I mean, most of these modern type firms, they have huge amounts of data on us already. And I think, Jeremy, you and I talked about this there recently in terms of, you know, I look at my teenagers and, you know, data privacy is not something they are unduly concerned about because they've always grown up in an environment where they're signing on and logging on and doing this, that and the other. Whereas when we grew up, well, actually, there was nothing to log on to, and therefore, you know, data privacy was not something we had to think about. But suddenly we're having to think about it because, you know, we're giving away data left, right, and center, or even if we're not giving it away, it's being collected on us. So I think if you look out into the future, it's probably, you would have probably, if I had a concern, it would be that data could be used against you because, I suppose if you go back to the economist said that humans were rational, and then the psychologist came along and said, no, they're far from rational. They do irrational things. In fact, quite often they act against their own best interests. And then the behavioral economist came along and said, well, actually, you can predict how irrational humans are, and therefore you can design products and services knowing that they're going to fall into these bear traps. And then, of course, you have conduct regulation, particularly in the likes of financial services, which says, well, you guys knew this anyway. So I think if you were looking out into the future, you'd have two concerns. One would be that data could be manipulated against people so that they actually act against their own best interests. And the other is, you know, you only have to look at the likes of Cambridge Analytica and whatnot, where, you know, data can be manipulated to change opinions,
but the other
rightly
but,
or wrongly.
But the other things are, for example, technology is advancing so fast that everybody's having to run to catch up with it. So even in small businesses, you've got to run to catch up with the technology and to integrate it in order to remain competitive and so on. But we're not in a position, it seems to me, to make decisions about whether we want this. And the law of unintended consequences says there are always going to be things that come out of it, which are not necessary to our advantage? And at what point do the people making decisions in the smaller companies and the larger companies say, well, actually, as an organisation, we have a responsibility over and above the responsibility that we have for our shareholders? So for the sake of argument, Amazon is a wonderful story, but it's driving huge numbers of businesses out of business because it's sort of sucking in all the sort of online retail trade, for example. And I don't think that was the intention. Offshoring, which has become, you know, and globalization, all consequences of digital transformation have had huge impacts on communities all around the world.
Not least the north of England, right?
Yeah, and we've had no say in it. And we haven't had the opportunity to say, actually, we think this is a good thing or a bad thing. We're aware of the consequences. And I remember in the 1980s, there was a guy called James Burke who had a program, and he prophesied this. He was saying, you know, one of the difficulties is that in the English language, I think there are something like 10,000 new words created every year. And of those words, 99.9% of them were sort of technical and scientific. And the only people who understood those words were the scientists and the technicians. So this whole language was being created, and decisions were being made within that language by that community. And the rest of us weren't even aware that it was available.
And I think if you looked at school, you would probably see in terms of language that there are now more children learning to code than there are learning another language. Because that language,
absolutely. But I think, Jeremy, you know, there's two ways you can look at it, and one is there's a guy called Dr. John Kabat-Zinn, who's one of these mindfulness guys, and you know, his phrase is, "You can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf."
Yes,
and for
I like
most
that.
For most businesses, they need to recognize that, well, actually, you know, the world is changing. And I need to do something about it. Now, when you bring it down to individuals, you know, what say have they got in the matter? Well, they do have a say, but if I suppose it comes back to your business, and if your consumers want to do things and they want to be able to, you know, avail of an experience from an Amazon, and you can't deliver that, you know, you have a business model actually that's broken. Right. And, you know, we go right through history. And like this, as I said earlier, this is the fourth industrial revolution. You know, when the first, second, third came along, you know, there were casualties and there were winners. And I think what we're seeing today is there are winners coming through in the fourth industrial revolution. And there are going to be firms, back to the Dell, survey, there's going to be a lot of casualties. And I think if you look at, there was a piece done by the World Economic Forum in terms of, you know, what are going to be the big jobs, or if you look out to 2022, what are the top 10 emerging jobs? And, you know, data analysts, AI and machine learning, you know, software and application, sales and marketing, funny enough, is in there. But I also think what's going to start coming through is you're going to have a much greater need for soft skills and the ability to be able to communicate based on an understanding of the hard data and the soft skills that are required. Because for the rest, you know, technology can do a lot of things. Technology can settle claims. Technology can open bank accounts. Technology can do diagnostics for medicals, etc. So, you know, we need to figure out for ourselves, you know, what is our role in all this? And then how do we upskill people so that they can contribute in a meaningful way, right? Because if the skills become redundant, and it's like everything else, you know, as with an MBS class there recently, and the professor asked at the end, so any advice for them? And I was talking about digital transformation, and my only advice to them was that it's up to them to keep their MBA current, because you know, the minute they finish it, well, the world will have moved on, and if they think, well, you know, I can put away my books now, that's not the way the world works. So you need to keep on top of this, and you need to keep retooling and reskilling, and having an eye to the future in terms of, you know, what am I going to need down the road?
It does seem to me there's this this dissonance between, because I take the view that, you know, high touch, high tech, you know, the more technology you've got, the more there is a demand for a more human environment as well. And it seems these two almost contradictory things are going on at the moment. One is this rush to technology and this huge revolution in technology. But at the same time, people need to feel more connected and more human. And the question is, how do you manage those two sides of the equation? And all this focus on technology and the power seems to be given to the technology companies and the big business that are driving these sort of changes in order to get productivity, in order to survive and so on and so forth, that the softer stuff is actually playing very much second fiddle, which again comes back to this thing about vision and values and
yes,
organizations making decisions about the sort of values they want, and shareholders and workers and whoever impacting on that. So we decide what sort of world we want rather than just be victims of it and constantly feel that we're having to run to catch up with it. Because the consequences of a lot of the things you're describing are, you know, if you go into many major organizations, the levels of stress there, mental illness, all of these things are, you know, becoming a real, real problem for all of us. You have, you know, the corruption of the use of information, you know, fake news and all this sort of stuff is a direct consequence of technological advances, because it's where you have technology can be used for good or bad. And unfortunately, sadly, a lot of it's being used badly. And we don't have in place the systems, the processes, the regulators to protect us from that. So I think there's a real issue about how you manage the transition between the world we have now and this digital world, this digitally transformed world, where we're making conscious where all of us are making conscious decisions about the world we want, rather than just being victims of it.
Yeah, and look, Jeremy, I think I read something there going back about 25 years or so, and it said if you were born in the 1800s, compared to someone living then, a person living 25 years ago got more information and insights in one edition of the daily newspaper than that person would have got in the 1800s in their whole life. Now, if you roll it forward and if you look at where we are today, we are bombarded with information. There is information, any amount of it, coming from every direction. And you are right in terms of, well, is it true? Just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true. And you see the likes of Facebook now sort of putting up their hands saying, well, actually, yeah, we do have a responsibility to make sure that you know whether the information getting to you is correct. So there is an issue in terms of just the sheer volume and the capacity to be able to differentiate between what is real news, what is bias, and what is fake. So I look at the when I go to the States quite a bit, and you know, you have two news channels, and you know, they're both biased one way or the other. I don't see any independent reporting of facts. And I think at least in the UK and Ireland, you know, there is an onus on the likes of the BBC to be able to say, well, let's report on the story and let's give both sides of the argument. And people are then left to make up their own mind. But that doesn't happen in every communication medium. You can get absolute slanted information, which is driving whole wadges of thinking and sentiment based on false premises. So there is an issue there that needs to be managed. And I think these technology firms are under the cosh in terms of if they are going to have their platform, and bear in mind they have massive, massive volumes of people on their platform, that they are going to have to make sure that what they are doing stands up to scrutiny.
But equally, I think that we shouldn't be leaving it to them to make the decisions about what's acceptable or not. And again, this is an old fox, young fox thing, because you know, there's this sort of assumption that kids, younger generation, digital natives and so on, aren't interested in privacy. For them, it's not important. They're used to it and blah, blah, blah. And I think it's up to older foxes to say, well, hold on, you know, the lessons of history tell us that privacy actually is quite important. In the early 1930s, in Holland, in the census, they introduced a new question. And the question was, what religion are you? And it was put in there for very reasonable reasons. I mean, it was because people were dying and people didn't know where to bury them. They didn't know whether to bury them in a, you know, Church of England or, a Catholic churchyard or whatever. And so, you know, or if they were Jewish, they didn't know whether to bury them in a Jewish cemetery. 4 years later, the Nazis walked into Holland and had a database full of all the Jews, where they lived, and rounded them all up. Now, if you've come out of Eastern Europe before the wall came down and you lived in an environment where you had the Stasi and so on, your attitude towards privacy and free speech will be completely different to our attitude toward it. And even at the moment, you look at our political system and we've seemed to have forgotten the importance of certain civil liberties that people fought for because we haven't had to apply them. But when they're absent, you notice these things in their absence. And I'm just conscious that the speed of change of all these technological things and the fact that isn't a sort of moral compass in the middle of it and you don't have any strong sort of civil society or regulation, we're leaving it all to the corporates to sort of interpret how these things should happen at the speed of it and the extent of it, I find that really concerning. And when you think about algorithms and the importance of algorithms in driving a lot of this change, and the fact that people who are the most effective people who write algorithms are probably on the spectrum and have an empathy deficit, it means the world is going to be governed by algorithms that have no empathy. They're anti-human. And it seems to me that is, these are huge issues, and they're not addressed unless, you know, the center of the conversation, there has to be some sort of element in the middle that takes account of all this.
Yeah, and I think, Jeremy, the issue, and I totally agree with you, like, you know, you look at someone like Facebook, they have 2.2 billion users. But the issue is that invariably regulation comes about because of failure. It rarely happens because, you know, we sit there around, the politicians sit around a table and say, you know what, the way this world is going in 5 years' time, it's going to look like this. So we better start thinking about the legislation for that now. That's not what happens, as you know. What they do is they sit down and say, what are the problems that we have today and how are we going to regulate for it? So I think you are right. But I think we also need to figure out, well, how are we going to get ahead of the curve? Because, you know, it's like all these things, you know, we can impose regulation today and then the next problem emerges and the next problem. And, you know, a bit, I suppose, like, the UK approach to financial services with principle-based regulation, there probably needs to be societal principle-based regulation of tech platform companies that says that, you know, you cannot, you know, go into these spaces or cause these issues. Because if you just say, well, you can't do X or Y, well, they'll do Z instead.
Mm. But is there any evidence when you're going around large organizations that these issues are seen as being current and important, or are they focused totally on driving out efficiencies in the business, productivity, shareholder value?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, Jeremy. And I think one of the things that, I think there's a big issue around whole shareholder value, because to me, the board's role in the organization is to act in the best interests of the company. And that's not necessarily in the best interests of the shareholders, because, you know, a company has many stakeholders, but the company should exist to serve its customers. Right. The fact that it makes money is a good outcome, perhaps, right? But it's not the reason they exist. So I think all of this fundamentally comes back to our business model and our understanding of our business model and what we stand for and what we are trying to do. And I think boards need to get more focused on that. Also, they need to be saying to themselves, well, if these things are happening, right, what is it that we need to be doing? But you can't address 100 things. So you need to understand for your business which things are most important, because otherwise you're clutching at straws and you can spend a whole load of money and it's still a analog organization with an analog culture with a load of money spent on a project that didn't work. And I think one of the big issues, Jeremy, that I see is if I walk into an organization and say, I'll tell you what we're going to do, we're going to automate your process for, you know, getting things from A to B. The accountants can look at that and say, oh, yeah, so it's going to cost X, it's going to, you know, reduce staff numbers by Y, it's going to reduce costs by this, and it's going to make us three times more efficient. So they can run an IRR on that or whatever their metric is. When you say to them, actually, we need to fundamentally change the organization, and that starts with mindset, and it starts with culture, and it starts around how we think and organize around our customers, around how we manage our processes, how we do this, that, and the other. And by the way, we might look for technology to support and enable that down the road. That's a real problem because the accountants can't measure that, right? So therefore they say, well, sure, we can't measure that. But the alternative to that is that, you know, down the road you can measure failure, as Thomas Cook did, because they failed to do all these things. And ultimately, you know, leaving the debt aside, I mean, if the company was hugely successful in terms of its business model, they probably could have taken care of the debt, or they probably wouldn't have taken on as much as they did, because they would have realized the acquisitions they were making were actually fulfilling their own demise as opposed to, you know, furthering their future. They might have made different acquisitions, the likes of what Amazon and these guys do, where they're looking to the future and sort of saying, well, we're here, but to get to the next phase, we need to buy that company because of this and this company because of that. So I think it all circles around that.
And what I'm hearing is I think the way that you're seeing businesses behave and need to behave in order to respond to the changing world around them. And that, I guess, from what Jeremy's saying, is that we could apply a lot of that self-awareness to our own lives as individuals in terms of how our children are using technology and how our own information is being used, but also as a local society and a broader
society. And as consumers, society. Because we will start making value-based decisions about who we buy our products and services from, which will feed into the drivers that help organisations decide how they're going to position themselves and design their
business. Exactly. And what you're saying, Tony, and what I'm hearing is that basically we can spectate or participate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you get so far spectating. Well, you know,
I'm just railing a little bit. I mean, I'm completely in harmony with what you're saying. It's just that I just get a little bit frustrated that there's this assumption that the path that we're on, the train we've got onto around everything speeding up, digitalization, productivity, all of these things, consumption. You know, it seems to me that is equally an old business model. We're not living in a world where we can afford to sustain all this stuff. So it's almost as though the digital piece is ready and waiting for a mindset change away from this old paradigm of consumption and competition and all this sort of stuff. And it's already in waiting for a sort of more enlightened model. And maybe I'm just going to sit here waiting forever. But
I think that's partly what you're saying, right, Tony, that you've got to look at the who and the what and the why rather than the how.
Yeah. So, what I'm saying is, you need to understand the why. You need to understand the how before you do the why. Because you know the problem is they're gone from why to what without actually understanding how.
Yes. Yeah.
And you need to understand that. Right? If you understand how you're going to change your organization, and Jeremy, if you can't change your organization and have it reflect the customer in as opposed to the organization out, right? Maybe your organization doesn't deserve to survive into the future.
I agree. But equally, I think you'll find a lot of people who aren't necessarily running the business might have that mindset. How do you actually try and manage that transition from halfway down the organization?
Yeah, and I think it comes back to this in my mind. You know, we used to talk in conduct regulation in terms of tone from the top, echo from the bottom, and engagement in the middle. Well, actually, culture change is what we're talking about here. And if the board and executive team understand their destination and they understand how they need to change to put them on that path, and they are bringing the whole organization with them, and everyone is saying, well, we know why we are going there, we know how we're going to go there, and we know what we're going to look like when we get closer to that destination. Now, that's a far more sustainable business than one where I've written an annual report, I've done an investor presentation, I've done a few nice platitudes to the market, I've made a few strategic appointments, which really have no mandate, and we'll hope for the best.
You've got a behavioralist on your team, haven't you?
We have access to a number of behavioralists on our team. We do have one lady who is into all of the psychology and psychotherapy and all those other things. But I would say, Jeremy, fundamentally, though, this is a business model thing. And you need to keep coming back to that because, you know, yes, you want to change behaviors and culture and that sort of stuff, but you have to be clear on your business model. If you're not clear on the business model and you're not clear on what that business model needs to look like into the future, Well, you know, yeah, all you're doing is spinning the wheels, or you're doing King Canute. You're trying to hold back the waves instead of learning how to surf.
What does the perfect client look like for you, Tony?
For us, it tends to be large SMEs to mid corporate. Very small businesses. Well, you know, they're kind of caught up in the day to day, and it's they probably are very close to what they are doing anyway. Very large businesses tend to have, you know, the big strategy firms in with them. So for us, it's medium to mid corporate. And what's important to me is I have no desire, Jeremy, to organize to work with an organization where basically you can't get access to the senior executive and board, because you need to have those people buying into, you know, what needs to happen, how it needs to happen, and what it will look like into the future. If you don't have that, you know, you're going to have, you know, something happening in some part of the organization, fundamentally being rejected by the rest of the organization, and nothing really changes.
And do you notice a difference between organizations that are coming to you because they've got a, you know, they know they've got a problem, and almost like a burning platform, and those who just see an opportunity? Is there something qualitatively different about how they take on board your recommendations and approach?
Yeah, I think. Look, in an ideal world, you have a CEO, and the CEO is saying, "I know this business is going to change, and I need to get ahead of that, and I need to understand what it means for, you know, this organization and our people, and so on, support." I have also worked in organizations where you have a sponsor, and it's clear that the CEO or other executives have no desire to be part of this transformation. And the interesting thing is, you don't have to say no. You can kill something by doing nothing, right? And because if I'm running a different division or department or whatever it might be, and I'm basically disengaged, and I'm not taking part of what you're done by Jeremy or Ali, all of my people see that. So yeah, they say, well, it's not important. Right. And the problem in most organizations, they do lots of initiatives because this one seems to be, oh, we better do this, or we need to do that, right? And then a couple of months in, it loses, you know, the impetus, because actually it's not really fundamentally important to the organization. It was just someone's bright idea at a point in time, or it was in response to what some competitor did, or, you know, some customer feedback. But it's not a journey that the organization is on. It's something that some part of the organization was doing something that fizzled out.
And are you saying that effectively that sort of flash and pan sort of knee-jerk reaction, the reason that that's not carrying through is because the leadership team, particularly the board, don't have in their mind clearly what's going on and where we need to go?
Yes, if they were really clear on their business model, they'd say, no, this is fundamental, right? This is non-negotiable. We need to start to see changes. We need to see new metrics. So I was working with one organization, and they showed me this fantastic piece of work they were doing on their transformation. And I said, look, it's all very good. I said, the one thing that struck me was that you have no metrics in terms of how you know you're succeeding. And they went away, and they came back to me the next day and said, all of our metrics are sunset metrics. They're very traditional. We don't have any sunrise metrics. So we actually are not measuring anything that would show us whether we're actually succeeding.
Wow.
And if you don't do that, and you can't evidence, you know, to the masses and to the board or whatever, that you're actually starting to have small successes, and it'll lose momentum.
Sure.
And there's nothing worse than being in a team or a business or a society where people start rolling their eyes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's the other interesting thing. We talked about this a bit earlier. I mean, the organization should be prepared to say, well, let's try this. And if it doesn't work, let's make a decision fast and stop it, right? What typically happens is, you know, an organization makes a bet, says we'll do the following, and then they realize it's not working. But egos and everything get in the way, and, you know, an unwillingness to say something's not working because of the way we're organized and structured. And rather than saying, no, we need to stop this and try the next idea, they persist with the old one. So that's a culture change. And you know, it wouldn't happen in a Google or a this, that, and the other. They'd be more than happy to say, you know what, we did this and it failed, but here's what we learned. So we're now going to do this, and we're going to take that learning with us, and we now are going to do that a little bit differently because we understand a bit more than we did yesterday.
Yeah, and they have the idea in Google of the design sprint, don't they, where they test an idea and work out if it's good or not in a week, as in Monday to Friday. If you were talking to young people who are just finishing uni and going into work and are A, choosing a company to work for, and B, looking at how they approach their career and the businesses they work for, what would you say to them in this context?
Well, look, I have one of those myself. I'm a 22-year-old just finishing university. And what I would like to see him do is to go into a more digital, you know, orientated company that's thinking about the future, as opposed to going into an analog organization where things are done because they've always been done that way. I think for me, it's around, you know, if I look at the young people, my sense is they don't think about employment the way we might have thought about employment. They are very much in a space that, you know, they will work places that have a value set that appeals to them, but they will work in many places. Right? So they're not thinking, well, if I get in there, I can get 35 years out of it. They're thinking, I can get in there and do a bit of experience and learn that, and then I can do something else. So I think their view of the world and our view of the world is a lot different. But I would say to them is, don't go into an analog organization with an analog culture.
Mm. Very good. Tony, how do people find you?
Oh, we're on the web, betadigital.net. That's the easiest way, I suppose, Jeremy. Or they could talk to you.
They could indeed, because you are a trusted partner of Independent Perspective. Brilliant. Listen, Tony, thanks ever so much for your help and for a very stimulating conversation. I shall look forward to more.
Great. Super. Thank you, guys.
And thanks for tuning in, folks. Of course, you know how to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes. And we look forward to the next conversation. This episode is brought to you by Independent Perspective, a strategic and creative UK-based consultancy. For a fresh perspective on your business, head over to independentperspective.co. Oh.